Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is Sutta 133, and if you just look back, you can see Sutta number 131 is where this series of teaching starts, the Bhadekarata Sutta, which says a single excellent night. 132, Ananda, and one single excellent night. This is Mahakachana, and one single excellent night. And then you have 134 is Loma Sakangiya, and a single excellent night. So four suttas are on almost the same topic. So it's a very famous teaching. And to begin with, that it was always a lot of controversy between the meaning of this, whether it meant one single excellent night or one single excellent attachment. And depending on what copy of the Majjhima Nikaya you have, if you have the original one, the earlier one, you'll find it has one single fortunate attachment, I believe it's called. So if you have the earlier edition of the Majjhima Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi had one single fortunate attachment. Because the word at the end, ratta, can mean night, but it can also mean like enjoyment or delight. Because when we have the Pali, sometimes the Pali abbreviates things, but fortunately that somebody found an earlier, another edition of these suttas in the Sanskrit. And the Sanskrit had Bhadeka Ratri, and Ratri is a word for night. So it's very clear that of the two possibilities, Ratta meaning a night or attachment, the night is the correct one. Which is why the later edition changed the title of this sutta to one single excellent night rather than a single fortunate attachment. So if you have a single fortunate attachment there, you can please change it. So, here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha, in the Park of the Hot Springs. For those of you who've been on pilgrimage to India, you know that just if we go to the Satapani Cave, that's the cave where, according to the history, that the monks recited the suttas for the first time, just after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, and that's usually on our tour of India. And to get to the Satapani cave, we walk through the Jain temple, or the Hindu temple, sorry, which contains the hot springs. And those hot springs are still there. And so you can actually see those hot springs. I've never known any Westerner actually bathe in them, because they took one look at them, and they're so dirty. But the hot springs are still there. And obviously that's exactly where the Buddha was staying, close by to. And so when you go to these places, you know, the hot springs, that's the only place where they have hot springs in that area. You know, that was the place they're talking about here. So that's where the Blessed One was staying, in the Park of the Hot Springs. Then when it was near dawn, you know, it was just before dawn, the Venerable Samidhi went to the hot springs to bathe himself, you know, choosing an early time in the morning when no one was going to be around. After bathing, he came out of the water and stood dressed in one robe, drying his limbs. Then when the night was well advanced, a certain deity of beautiful appearance, who illuminated the whole of the hot springs, approached the Venerable Samidhi. Standing on one side, the deity said to him, these are the devas. And you can see that traditionally, if you look through these suttas, the devas always appear just before dawn. You know, when the night is far advanced, before dawn has happened, that's when the devas come out. Which is one of the reasons that, you know, people in Australia don't see devas these days. Because they don't get up early enough. So, the deva came up to the monk and said, "Monk, do you remember the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night, the Bhadekarata Sutta? You know, do you remember it?" "Friend, I do not remember the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. But friend," talking to the deva, "do you remember the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night?" "Monk, I too do not remember the summary and exposition of one who had a single excellent night. But monk, do you remember the stanza of one who has had a single excellent night? Friend, I don't even remember the stanza of one who has had a single excellent night. But friend, do you remember that stanza of one who has had a single excellent night? Monk, I too do not remember the stanza of one who has had a single excellent night. So, you know, it's a pretty miserable exchange so far. But the Deva says, but monk, learn the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. Monk, master the summary and exposition of one who has had a single night, excellent night. Monk, remember the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. Monk, the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night is beneficial. It belongs to the fundamentals of the holy life. That is what was said by the deity, who thereupon vanished at once. So obviously the deity knew it was important, but he didn't actually know why. So, having had that, if that happens to you and you see a deva and said, you must learn this important sutta, I'm sure that you would actually be quite inspired and try and find out what it's all about, which is what Venerable Sarmidi did. So then, when the night was over, the Venerable Sarmidi went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had occurred, and said, it would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would teach me the summary and exposition of one who has had a single excellent night. Then, monk, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Sarmidi replied. And the Blessed One said this. So that's the prologue so far. The deva wanted to press upon this monk, this was really important. So the monk went to see the Buddha, and then the Buddha repeated this, what was obviously a very important and famous poem in the time of the Buddha. And here it is. Let not a person revive the past, or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it. Invincibly, unshakably, today the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargaining with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Then soon after the Blessed One has gone, the monks, not just the Sarmidi, but the other monks were listening, considered, now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expanding the detailed meaning. So they had this phrase here, and they want to say, well, what does it really mean? Some of it you can understand, but other stuff, what does it mean? Now, who will expound this in detail? Then they considered the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher, and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He is capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this. Then the monks went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down to one side and they told him what had taken place, adding, let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us. There's many cases in the suttas where the Buddha gives a brief teaching and the monks don't really understand what it means, and they let the Buddha go back to his room without actually asking him. Because sometimes that people in Asia were just too over-respectful of the teacher. So they don't want to bother him, they let him go, but then they really should have asked the questions which were bothering them to understand the Dhamma completely. And so Venerable Mahakachana, as he replies in other places when asked to expound what the Buddha said in brief, gives the same phrase. Friends, it is so a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree, standing possessed of heartwood. after he had passed over the root and trunk. He's making the point here that the Buddha is like the trunk, the heartwood, and being one of the disciples of the Buddha, he's just like a branch or just like a twig. And so it is with you, Venerable Sirs, that you think that I should be asked about the meaning of this, after you passed the Blessed One by when you were face to face with the teacher. For knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He is vision. He is knowledge. He is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One. He is the Sayer, the Proclaimer, the Elucidator of meaning, the Giver of the Deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered. And the monks agree, yes, surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, he is the Tathagata. That was the time when we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told us, so we should have remembered it. Yet the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by the wise companions in the holy life. The Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this summary, given in brief by the Blessed One, without expounding the detailed meaning. Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the monks replied, and the Venerable Mahakachana said this. So that's again just the fill there, just to say that they wanted to understand the deeper meaning of this, and Mahakachana starts to give that meaning. Friend, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expanding the detailed meaning, that is, let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargaining with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night. I understand the detailed meaning of it to be as follows. So here we got the commentary. Now just pause a minute here, that you can see that even from the time of the Buddha, there will be some phrases like this, and some of the monks wouldn't really understand it completely. So it asks some other monks, can you please explain it? And from here we get the tradition of commentaries in Buddhism. Now this, we can actually say here, is almost like a commentary of that phrase or that little poem. And later on, obviously, that people wrote commentaries on these commentaries, explaining it in more detail. And that's where we got the tradition in Buddhism. We have the Sutta Pitaka. We also have many, many books which have the explanations or commentaries on those teachings of the Buddha. And they become huge amounts of volumes, which were varied and many, but about 1,000 years after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, they were all brought together, edited, collected together, especially by Acharya Buddhaghosa, and they became the accepted, almost semi-canonical, Attakatha, or the commentaries on not just the suttas, but on Vinaya and Abhidhamma. So you can see the commentaries, it is a tradition you see in the suttas, and it was expanded after the time of the Buddha. Before we go further, any comments so far? Or questions? Okay, let's get into the heart of it then. How, friends, does one revive the past? You know, the first line of the poem. Thinking, my eye was thus in the past, and forms were thus. Forms are just what the eye sees. The eye is the organ of sight, forms are the objects of sight. Where's it gone now? My eye was thus in the past, and forms were thus. One's consciousness became bound up with desire and lust for that. Because one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one revives the past. And similarly for the other five of the six senses. Thinking my ear was thus in the past, and sounds were thus in the past, my nose and odors, tongues and flavors, body and tangibles, my mind was thus in the past, and mind objects were thus, and one's consciousness becomes bound up with desire and lust for that, because one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust, one delights in that, when one delights in that, one revives the past. That is how one revives the past. Now, it's fascinating there that you're seeing that the Mahakachana is analyzing that in terms of the six senses. And in particular, that, you know, you start to, because a person starts to remember the sense experiences of the past, and the most important thing is one's consciousness becomes bound up with that, with desire and lust for those sensory experiences of the past, and because one's consciousness becomes bound up with desire and lust for those things of the past, one delights in that. When one delights in that, then one revives the past. That is how one revives the past. And to me, that's very important, that it's not just that you remember the past, but you have like this desire or lust for things which happened in the past, almost like the interest. And because of that, you're delighting in the past. And I would even add that people even delight in some of the negativity which happened in the past. Even the bad experiences in the past, there's a certain delight in that. And that's why one gets bound up in it. Even if it's like a grief or a bad memory of something which happened in the past. What the Buddha is actually pointing out here, and I think it's a very powerful psychological truth, if there wasn't a form of delight in remembering even the unpleasant experiences of the past, if there isn't something in it for you, in a sort of sense of building up a self, then one would not keep worrying and being concerned and building up the past. Certainly I remember that when I went to a conference on grief and loss, and seeing a person there who was unable to let go of their grief for a child who got tragically killed many years previously. But I could also see that the reason why they would not give up their grief was because they got many benefits from being the grieving parent. That was their sense of identity, and they got much compassion. They were considered to be a special person, and I could see the gratification which they got from dwelling in their grief and actually exposing that painful emotion to others. Sorry, please. Indeed. I believe that's true, yes. Well, the Buddha says, he says in many places, if there wasn't a gratification there, then you would not get bound up with it. And he used the word gratification rather than the more stronger words like lust. Because lust or desire seems to be only for delightful objects. But there's also the psychology there, which, you know, you would know, that sometimes, why is it that, you know, people actually read the newspapers and focus on all the terrible things which happen? Or why is it that people would, you know, seek out or like traffic accidents and just watch there? Even though there's, you know, a lot of pain, a lot of tragedy, there is a certain type of gratification there. People will call it ghouls, but then, you know, a lot of other people would go there as well. Nobody home right now, I think, or the idea that being home is not comfortable, there's no contentment there, and one was looking for some sort of gratification somewhere else. I think it's like not noticing or realizing the gratification of the present moment. If there was no desire and lust, the Buddha say, you'd have let it go. Which is fascinating, because, you know, sometimes you come across, you know, people had terrible past lives. No, terrible early lives, sorry. You know, and they may have been raped, sexually abused, physically abused. you know, in having the trauma of, you know, being in a war zone. And Buddha's making a point here, and I would it's a very radical point, but I would actually agree with it, is that there is some sort of gratification in keeping those memories alive, in reviving the past. I think that one of the cravings, as you would know, is not just the craving for sensory pleasure, but the craving to be, the bhava-dhanna, the craving to exist. And there is a certain delight. One, obviously, one would delight much more in pleasurable existence, but given the choice between not existing at all and existing with pain, people choose to exist without pain. It gives you a sense of existence and being, even though it's unpleasant. Yeah. So, I mean, that's why there is a gratification to the pain of the past. So, reviving the past, I mean, I've also noticed this, obviously talking with Buddhists here in the West for many years. When we do revive the past, what people do revive is the painful memories of the past. And very few people revive the pleasant memories of the past. When you think really that there should be more delight and gratification remembering the wonderful things you had happen to you. Obviously, sometimes you remember the past, you know, talking with a person when you went to that great concert with Jimi Hendrix, or, you know, when you went sort of out as a young man. But so many people actually remember that when they revive the past, they revive the negative part of the past. And you know that story of the two chicken farmers, you know, and collecting the shit or collecting the eggs, which I use very often. You know that one, don't you? Yeah, sure. You can see that the reason why people laugh at that one is because it really rings home that they do collect from the past the shitty stuff rather than the beautiful stuff. So when they do revive the past, they do revive more of the negative aspects of the past. And interesting here, the Buddha's saying it's a gratification, there's a joy, there's a delight there, which is why they do it. And if you can see that delight and see why you do it, in other suttas they say that's the path out of it. Seeing the delight in it, because, you know, sometimes we can't see that. We think, yeah, there can't be delight in it. I remember the time I was raped, or I was beaten, or I was really humiliated. I'm sure there can't be any delight there. Is that true? Is there some sort of form of gratification there? Yes. Exactly. Self-building, that's what I would say. It's the delight in being a self, in existing, bhava-dhanha, the craving to be. Yeah. Indeed, I think it's why we don't let go of those things. It's a type of gratification that we can't see. I think that the mind would hold on to these. They would attach to these things because they delight in it somehow or other. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, because it's very easy to let go. Yeah, something's working. We know what it's like. It's very easy when somebody rattles a tin in front of you, you know, to sort of give, 50% of what you have in your wallet. But to give 100%, that's the hard one. It's very easy to give some of your time. But to give, all of your time. It's very easy. They say, like the thoroughbred horse or elephant. This is in Buddhist similes. the one who's like trained in an army would actually give 100% and would not protect any part of their life in a battle. And only then are they the perfect horse who has 100% commitment. But if they only can actually give 90% and they're protecting some part of their body, they say they're not a good battle elephant. So it's very easy to give up 90%. Very easy to give them 99%. It's 100% is the hard part. Any other comments, questions there? Okay. And obviously the same is not just with the sights, with the sounds, smells, tastes, physical experiences, and also mind objects as well. The reason is my mind was thus in the past, and mind objects were thus. One's consciousness became bound up with this desire and lust for that. Because one's consciousness was bound up with desire and lust, one delighted in that. When one delights in that, then one revives the past. That is how one revives the past. So how does one not revive the past? How does one let go? Thinking my eye was thus in the past and forms were thus, one's consciousness does not become bound up with the desire and lust for that. Because one's consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust for that, one does not delight in that. Because from not delighting in that, one does not revive it. There's also another thing which you all know from your meditation, that if you are having a wonderful, beautiful time now, if you're delighting in, say, the beautiful music, then it's impossible to think of the past. So sometimes that stopping delight in the past, even delight in negative parts of the past, can be achieved by having something right now which you delight in much more. So the delight being a relative, if you can't have anything now which is nice, you pick up something, anything in the past, or in the future coming soon. Because, you know, you don't value, you don't appreciate, you can't delight in what's happening now. Which is one other way of letting go of the past, is having a happier present. Which I think what you were saying, if you can encourage people to enjoy this moment and find more value in their life which is happening right now, then they can let go of the delight in their past by having more delight in their present. So when one doesn't delight in that, one does not revive the past. I also mention here, it's not that these thoughts, they just come from nowhere and invade your mind. Because sometimes you think, oh, it's just a thought came. I didn't know where it came from nowhere, and it just came into my mind. But I know my mind well enough now through meditation. That thought didn't come by itself. I invited it in. I actually sought it and actually brought it in. So these things, they don't just come out of nowhere. You go looking and searching for them. And if you had more mindfulness, you'd actually see that. The reason is because you're bored with silence, you're bored with peace, you're not delighting in it. So you just go out seeking for something else. It's exactly what Ajahn Chah meant when it's not the sound disturbs you, you disturb the sound, you go out looking for something to disturb yourself with. I've seen that so often. You're having a peaceful time in meditation, the body's nice and comfortable, you say, oh, what's happening with my leg? And you go looking for something to disturb yourself. Or you go looking in the past, what can I think of? Or what can I plan next? Literally, you do seek those thoughts out. So you do revive them. So how does one, next paragraph 15, how, friends, does one build up hope upon the future? Now, of course, when we translate from the Pali here, it's sometimes a bit difficult. Like, just hope is just, you know, any wishing or wanting for something to happen in the future. Thinking my eye may be thus in the future and forms may be thus, this is just a sense of sight, one sets one's heart on obtaining what has not yet been obtained. Because one sets one's heart thus, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one builds up hope upon the future. Thinking my ear may be thus in the future and sounds may be thus, my nose and odors, tongue and flavors, body and tangibles, my mind may be thus in the future and mind objects may be that, one sets one's heart on obtaining what has not yet been obtained. Because one sets one's heart that, thus one delights in it. When one delights in that, one builds up hope upon the future. That is how one builds up hope upon the future. So we do delight in planning and hoping, but not just for pleasant objects, because you know actually we delight in being afraid of what's going to happen next. People love hearing ghost stories, or they love seeing these movies. I remember going to see the movie of The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock, and that's one of the scariest movies which I had ever seen. I'm sure there's many more scary movies these days. But I was so scared afterwards. You went outside, you saw a couple of birds on a line, and you think, oh my goodness, this is happening. But I enjoyed that. I delighted in that fear, as many people do. And so you can see that sometimes the hopes for the future, not just pleasant hopes, but something, anything to excite you, to stimulate your idea of existing and being. I think that's one of the reasons why. When people say this, they go in these, I remember as a kid, I saw like a Saturday afternoon sport. And no, I had a motorbike as a kid, you know, as a young man. And that was scary enough. But these people were going down the track. I don't know how fast they were going around the track. But they took it one level further and they put ice on the track. So it was like, motorbikes on ice. And I thought, gee, I mean, that's really pushing it too far. The only way they could do it is have actually spikes, you know, on the rubber tires to make sure that they could actually get some sort of grip on the ice track. And they were going, 150 miles an hour around this track. And of course, every now and again, one would come off and they had to really, you know, avoid the spikes, otherwise get ripped to death. And I thought, who on earth would want to do things like that? But now I understand why people want to do things like that. Because with that fear, you really become alive. You know, your idea of being. Why would anybody actually want to fight in Iraq? But people actually like it after a while. And they can't imagine a life anywhere else. Adrenaline is one thing. They delight in fear. Yeah. So, yes. Oh, I think there's probably a bit of subconscious sort of wanting it to happen for a while. Well, sometimes it's a bit of boredom and just looking for something. And something, what you look for is actually, you know, a bit more than you expected. But you wanted something to fill out the gap. But I reckon, you know, you can actually investigate this. I reckon that you bring it on yourself. You know, you seek it out. It's our defilements, yeah. It's defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion. But even like hatred, why do people hate things? You know, why don't they just let anger go? And the reason is because you enjoy getting angry. You know, many people who enjoy getting angry, they get a buzz out of it. And until you can stop enjoying it and see it's painful and see its negative results, you'd always get involved and get into anger. That really told them. You do feel alive. You get the adrenaline rush. You get the sense of a bolster to your ego. So you get the happiness of existing. So, because one sets one's hearts on these things and delights in it, that's how one builds up hope in the future, and that's how this happens. So if you didn't delight in these things, then the mind wouldn't rush off to the future. But it's true, actually, that most people, when they look at the past, they get all the negative stuff from the past. When they look to the future, they get all the nice fantasies and dreams and hopes of when they win the lotto and what they will do with it. So it's fascinating. When you do go searching for the future, you tend to look for the beautiful things which happen in the future. Except for the fear and worry people. Does that make any sense? So, thinking, not just sights, thinking my ear may be thus in the future, and sounds may be thus, nose and odors, tongue and flavors, body and tangibles, mind may be thus in the future, and mind objects may be thus, one does not set one's, how does one not build up one's hope upon the future? Paragraph 16. How, friends, does one not build up hope upon the future? Thinking, My eye may be thus in the future, and forms may be thus. One does not set one's heart on obtaining what has not yet been obtained. Because one does not set one's heart thus, one does not delight in that. When one does not delight in that, one does not build up hope upon the future. Thinking my ear may be thus in the future, and sounds may be thus, my nose and odors, tongue and flavors, my body and tangibles, my mind may be thus in the future, and mind objects may be thus, one does not set one's heart on obtaining what has not yet been obtained. Because one does not set one's heart thus, one does not delight in that. When one does not delight in that, one does not build up hope upon the future. That is how one does not build up hope upon the future. So you don't look for obtaining what has not yet been obtained. In other words, one does things like, this is good enough. That wonderful little mantra which we teach in meditation, this is good enough. So you're not seeking for anything more. And that goes as well as for material goods, as well as spiritual goods. So you don't go, oh, may I get jhana. Oh, may I get so-on. Oh, may I become enlightened. Oh, may I be able to levitate. Oh, may I be able to read my mind to find out whether my husband is really cheating on me or not. Instead of doing things like that, one actually just has this contentment with the present moment and not trying to obtain what you haven't yet obtained. Now that's actually the first two parts of the verse. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. This is like basically the present moment awareness. And even we have that book by Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. It's called Power of Now, isn't it? Yeah, whatever it is. Then you can see that people say, oh, this is basic Buddhist teachings. But yeah, you quote especially Bhadekarata Sutta to actually show this is exactly what the Buddha taught 25 centuries ago. The past has been left behind, the future has not been reached, so don't revive the past or build hopes on the future. Instead, with insight, let him see, this is vipassana, each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it. Invincibly, unshakably. Now we go on to what invincibly, unshakably means. How is one vanquished in regard to presently arisen states? In regard to the eye and forms that are presently arisen, one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust for that which is presently arisen. Because one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one is vanquished in regard to presently arisen states. In regard to the ear and sounds that are presently arisen, the nose and odors, tongue and flavors, body and tangibles, the mind and mind objects that are presently arisen, one's consciousness is bound up with desire and lust for that which is presently arisen. Because one's consciousness is bound up with that desire and lust, one delights in that. When one delights in that, one is vanquished in regard to presently arisen states. That is how one is vanquished in regard to presently arisen states. So that's the opposite of being invincible. So we see what the opposite, first of all, being vanquished, and obviously the opposite, invincible in regard to presently arisen states. In regard to the eye and forms that are presently arisen, one consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust for that which is presently arisen. Because one's consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust, one does not delight in that. When one does not delight in that, one is invincible in regard to presently arisen states. In regard to the ear and sounds that are presently arisen, the nose and odors, tongue and flavors, the body and tangibles, mind and mind objects that are presently arisen, one's consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust for that which is presently arisen. Because one's consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust, one does not delight in that. When one does not delight in that, one is invincible in regard to presently arisen states. That is how one is invincible in regard to presently arisen states. When it says here, invincibly, unshakably, let him know that and be sure of it, each presently arisen state. One thing which I would add here, it's actually fascinating that when one does do a present moment awareness, one stays in this moment, that sometimes that people say that that's all one needs to do, just to be mindful. And I think actually they've got a good point there. if they are just mindful of this present moment, and they're not having desire for this present moment, they're not bound up by it, usually what happens is that present moment starts to, I wouldn't say evolve, but involve, to go deeper and deeper and deeper. It's always, I've seen in my meditation, that if you just stay in this present moment just now, and just usually the breath just comes up by itself as the whole body just disappears, and the breath is usually what's left with the disappearance of the body. But the body does not disappear if you are delighting in it, if you are interested in it, if you are get involved in it. In that case, I would say you are vanquished by the body, you're not invincible. In other words, the body is really taking up all your attention. And so you keep feeling the body. But if you are invincible, you're just watching in this present moment, this body, soon the body disappears. Because you're not delighting in it, you don't sort of stay with it. It just vanishes. What you delight in, you remain with. It conquers you, rather than you conquer it. Yeah. Usually, you can actually move it if you've only got half an hour. But sometimes I think it's much better, in my own practice, I don't sort of set time limits. Usually just watch the body, and the body just disappears because it's comfortable. You're not delighting it. You're not getting caught up with it. If you don't getting caught up with it, it's not holding your attention anymore. It vanishes because you're not delighting in it. It doesn't bind. Natural. Correct. That's right. The simile which you've heard me say before, a thousand petal lotus. You put your attention on one thing and just keep it there, and then the lotus opens up. But in that simile, you must make sure you don't get bound up with that particular leaf. Otherwise, it never opens. It's an important part of meditation, because I think people get stuck there. They're sort of, you know, staying with the body, but nothing happens. Or they get into, say, the breath. They stay with the breath, but nothing happens. It doesn't sort of turn into a beautiful breath. Or a beautiful breath doesn't turn into a nimitta. Or a nimitta never turns into a jhana. Loving kindness actually softens. It takes away the delight. The lust part of it. Still the joy part of it, but not sort of a hard controlling lust. Yes. Yes. That's what I would say. Because like the real loving kindness, the way I understand it, is very much a letting go. That's why, you know, it's, the door of my heart is open. No matter what you do, no matter who you are, no matter what happens. It's that unconditional aspect of loving kindness, which is stops the delight happening. And stops of being bound up and controlling it. And I think this is an important part, because to get into the deeper meditations, you can be with the breath. And you can watch the breath for a long time, but it doesn't sort of, I call it involve. I call it evolve. It doesn't develop at all. And I think that's one of the big problems with meditators. They can watch the breath, but why can't you go deeper? It's in the present moment. Why can't it go deeper? Because there's a sort of delight, a holding onto it, an attachment to it. You can't let it go. You can't let it go into a deeper state because you're delighting in it. In the same way you can delight in negative things of the past. This is an experience. It's you. You hold on to it. Make any sense? Yes, Jacob. Unshakable, where's it got here? Where do we actually say that? Oh yeah, invincibly, unshakably. Well, that's an interesting one, because very often unshakably does mean sort of the deep absorption, but I think here, it's probably as I was saying there, that you're still with each one of these states. So the aspect of stillness would mean that's one of the reasons when you don't get when you don't delight in it, when you don't get attached to it, you don't get involved in it, then things stop shaking. The mind becomes still. You experience deeper states of stability. It's very much the same as, you know, if the simile which I keep on doing. You hold a glass of water. When you hold a glass of water, you're always shaking. Because that's the nature of muscles in the arm. The only way you can get the glass of water still, to make this glass of water unshakable, is let it go. In other words, detach, disengage. You do need delight in something to get deeper, but it's a delight is more like a satisfaction. A satisfaction, a contentment, rather than a more lustful, a more attaching delight. Difference between a love which a person has to their partner, which is very attached, and the love of metta, which is a detached love. It has the unconditional part to it, that I will love you no matter who you are, no matter where you go. The love which you have to have that person around, you demand things of them, and the love which can actually allow things to disappear. So I think there's a different type of delight, different flavor of delight. How about Data Pitti Sukha? There are many flavors of Pitti Sukha. If it's a Pitti Sukha born of letting go, which is a different type than the Pitti Sukha born of attaching to things. Pitti Sukha, once you get sort of a new jacket or something, or you get a sort of a new sort of iPod to listen to the Dharma talks, and there's a delight in that. But some of that is a delight of attachment. Because it's mine, or it's a new thing, a newfangled toy. But when you listen to the Dharma talks, you get another type of delight, which is the delight of just, peace, letting go. This is freedom at last. Oh, this is so nice. It's a different type of Pitti Sukha, because of a different cause. This is actually one of the other sutras, the Anuvibhanga Sutta. That will answer the question more canonically, where the Buddha said, and you should be able to distinguish between the pleasures. They call it the Amisa Sukha, the pleasures which are part of the world, and the Niramisa Sukha, the pleasures nothing to do with the world. And those two different types of pleasures, you should know. You should distinguish between them. And the ones which are to do with the world, you should not follow. You should avoid them. You should be afraid of them. But the pleasures which have nothing to do with the world, which has the Pitti Sukha of deep meditation, so that one you should not be afraid of. You should follow, make much of, indulge in. So there are two different types of delight. Arana Vibhanga. Where's that? It's in the last 50. The discourse on non-conflict. It's a great sutta. Okay. So where were we? We're on Invincible. In other words, one is not conquered. The whole path towards enlightenment, one doesn't become almost like, you might say, a loser. And if one consciousness is not bound up with desire and lust, one does not delight in this, then one is invincible in regard to arisen present states. Now I'm just going to go on to the rest of the verses there, which isn't commented on. So let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly unshakable. Today the effort must be made, tomorrow death may come, who knows? Remember, this is called A Single Excellent Night, and I think this is where the title of this sutta comes from, the second half of this poem. Because today the effort must be made. In other words, do it tonight, because tomorrow the death may come. No bargain with mortality, with your death, can be made. And people always make bargains with their death. When they get cancer, oh, just give me another 3 months, give me 6 months, give me a year. Please, because I've got so much things to do. I promise, I go to the Buddhist Society every Friday night if you give me one more year. And it's amazing how many people make bargains with death when it comes close. So the Buddha's making it clear here that no bargain can be made with death. There's no sort of appeals court or administrative appeals tribunals with your death. When it's come, you're stuffed. You're stuck with it. No bargain can be made with it. And they always had this simile in ancient India of like death and its hordes, like an army of people coming to sort of take away your life. That's just a metaphor of India many years ago, of death and his hordes coming to take you away. So no bargain with mortality can keep the lord of death and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, dwells thus means not reviving the past, not building up his hopes in the future, and not being invincible. So being invincible, not being vanquished by the present moment. A very simple teaching. Not being vanquished by the present moment, keeping away the past, keeping away the future. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day and night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, has had a single excellent night. That is how one is invincible in regard to presently risen states. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expanding the detail meaning, that is, and he goes through the whole poem again, I understand, Mahakachana is saying here, I understand the detail meaning of this summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish to go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this, as the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Then the monks, having delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, Then, Venerable Sir, we went to the Venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning. The Venerable Mahakachana expanded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and phrases. Mahakachana is wise, monks. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way the Mahakachana has explained it. Such is its meaning, and you should remember it. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there you have, like a simple sutta. But it's obviously was very, very highly regarded by the early monks. So much so, it is repeated four times. There's four separate suttas. And in this one, which was a request to actually to read this out, you can see it is explained, and especially in terms of the six senses. There's a way of including all experience, all parts of the universe. These are different ways of splitting up the world as it can be known through the six senses and the six sense bases and consciousness, and to show exactly what this means in terms of the framework of the six senses. Simple, but very powerful. And I think it's because of its simplicity and power, it was one of the most famous poems, certainly in the time of the Buddha, and its fame has been preserved for us over the many centuries. So, it's a great meditation teaching. It tells us not to go to the past, not to go to the future, and why we go to the past. Why we go to the future, why we keep doing those things. When we get rid of the past and the futures, the present moment, to make sure we're not vanquished by the present moment, to let it go. And I've added this bit to see it evolve into more and more peaceful states. That's a sign you're not being vanquished, you're not being stuck by the present moment. And by so doing, that you are a person who has a single excellent night. Comments? Yeah. Oh, that's another point, yeah, because just the way that we say a day means 24-hour period, even though we understand a day means a day plus a night, in the same way in Pali, it was the night was the more important thing, and one night was actually sometimes a 24-hour period. So it did have the dual meaning of the whole 24-hour period or just the period of darkness. So both are quite valid translations of Rattri. In the same way as a day could mean like daylight, the sort of the maybe 13-14-hour period of where one can see unaided, but it could also mean the 24-hour period. Yes. Into joy. I think it's again just the way that we have our sense of self is very, very bound up with the experience in which we're used to. The fear becomes our comfort zone. We're used to that, and we get many benefits from the fear. And it's like the benefits from them. We can't, very often we don't see the negative, the problems and troubles which come from that fear, what it does to our body, what it does to our mind. But if that's all we really know, that's our usual comfort zone, that's where we feel we belong, that's where we stay. It's difference is scary. Change is scary. And it's all similarly that the last story which I wrote in the book of Open the Door of Your Heart was the story of the worm in the pile of dung. And it's a classic story there that, you know, you're trying to take a worm out of a pile of dung, and the worm doesn't want to go because it's used to its dung, and it smells nice, and it's food, and it's warm and cozy. And it's a great story there because it's like trying to take a person out of their pain. You say, no, it's nice to be out of the pain. They don't know because it's warm and cozy in here. I like this. I'm used to it. This is my food. It feeds the sense of self. To take them out of it is very hard. Sometimes because they don't want to go. And as a therapist, sometimes they don't want to go. They don't want to be free. Yes or no? Yeah, I think it's the whole point is like the sense of self. I mean, when there is a sense of self, the sense of self, you know, has to have some business to be done, has to do something. That's its function. And when the sense of self doesn't have anything to do, sometimes it feels hasn't any meaning in the world, hasn't any function, hasn't got any place in this world, it's not doing something, or it's not contributing. And I think that sense of a self doing something, from the doing we get the controlling, and from the controlling, you know, which is affecting the world around us, we get the defilements, especially the ones of, you know, desire and the frustration of desire called ill will. And I think that does build up a sense of self. You know that sort of the control freaks, the ones in power, you know, they don't want to give up their power. You know, John Howard, for example, doesn't want to give up sort of being Prime Minister because that's who he is. He's been Prime Minister for so long. That's his comfort zone, and he'd be afraid of not being Prime Minister again. Even though there'd be many, many benefits. He's got a huge pension, doesn't have to worry about the press anymore, could sleep in the morning. Sort of, you know, why on earth didn't you want to give up being Prime Minister? He's had a good time, he had lots of money, he's, you know, done a decent job. But people don't want to give that up, because that's the sense of self and ego. And you can see that on a big scale, but see that on a small scale. Letting go of thinking. Why can't we just stop thinking? Because thinking is the way our sense of self interacts with the world. In the same way, like a government, you can see that in the government they have all these debates and arguments. That's exactly what happens in the mind. Debating and arguing about what you're going to do, who was right, who was wrong, how you're going to do your future, what your plans are. It's almost like a little government in the mind. And that's very hard to let go of, because to let go of that thinking means you're letting go of controlling. And letting go of controlling means you're not existing anymore. The self is fading away. But I'm dying in a big way. Not just the body dying, but the sort of the mind dying. And again, one doesn't delight in that, one delights in being. So one delights in thinking. Proliferation, one delights in proliferating. Because, you know, we've got a sort of good mind, had a nice cup of coffee. What can I proliferate again today? Let's go and build the next Buddhist society. Now, the retreat center. I can proliferate exactly how it's going to be. You know, you've done the retreats before, Chris. Can you proliferate? How would you build a retreat center? And if you go on that path, you can actually start building it in your head. And it's just hours go waste by. But you feel alive. You're doing something. You are somebody. So I think this is why the attachment part of things, upadana, is the word means fuel. A fuel for what? Attachments are a fuel for the ego, for the self. Indeed, the mind it stops. It fades away. When you stop delighting in things, then not only the future and the past disappears, but so does the present. And that's the amazing thing about the deeper stages of Buddhism. They have, in other words, of like viraga, which is, the word viraga is sometimes called dispassion, but it's also sometimes called fading away. It has a dual meaning there, and it's a fading away part, which I love the best. Because the mind is fading, disappearing. And so is, you know, what the mind experiences. Because, you know, they, as it says in many suttas, the mind and the mind objects are like two sheaves of reeds. They lean across each other. You take one away, the other one disappears. You take away the objects of the mind, the things to think about, the past and the future and the present, consciousness or mind also falls apart. With that? Yeah. Yeah, sure. That's right, yes. So you've got the fuel, which is, you know, bringing up the sense of self, and that sense of self becomes the fuel for the future. Because that sense of self demands, it needs, it, its whole function is to sort of interact with the world and create, manipulate, and get involved. And the more fuel you have, the bigger the fire. The more attachment, the more delight, the bigger the sense of self. And that's why even negative people have a very strong sense of self. Which is why sometimes they don't want to give it up, because it's giving up them. It's like spiritual suicide. And it's an important point, because sometimes it's teaching meditation for such a long time. You know, people, their mind wanders. And say, instead of saying, stop it and just use your willpower, the way of Buddhism is always saying, why do you wander? What's the cause of that? Another reason is because you're delighting in something. Well, why are you delighting? What's the cause of delight? Because that gives you a sense of you're here, existing. And that's the ultimate cause, the delusion of a self. And wanting that self to be the Bhava Dhanha. Oh, no, no. The body does not always have a bodily... So delight does not always... No. No, delight has not always got a bodily thing in it. The delight has always got an ego, a sense of self behind it. And it could actually just play anywhere. With the body or with other things. Inanimate things. Even like delight in just concepts and ideas. Like great philosophers or science fiction writers. Or even like physicists. The delight in strings or black holes and these weird concepts which you really can get off on. Why do you do that? It's just because you have a sense of existing. That's me. So it's the delight which feeds the sense of self. The fuel. Indeed, yes. You're not only understanding of not self, but you tend to do much less. You become more peaceful, purple. You don't need so much control to actually to be happy in the world, or to be peaceful. You don't need to keep asserting yourself. Yeah. So you see that and it just stops. So you can fade away. Any other questions before I fade away to a certain time? Okay, that was a short sutta today. But that was actually a nice one to have it short sometimes, especially I've had a very busy day, walking in the morning, blessing a baby before lunch, having a lunch, committee meeting, and now this. So I've had a very busy day. It's been one fortunate day for me. Okay, so let's pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can all go do what we need to do.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sanghang Namami